Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Maybe we haven't been here before that is facing the particular climate change issues of our age, but climate change is not new. In this cut from a new documentary about the relationship between public health and climate change, OSU paleoclimatologist Lonnie Thompson explains why glacial excavations can help predict the future.
What is very clear is that there aren't any better archives of our past than what you'll find right here in this ice. And of course, they provide us with the history of greenhouse gases and the bubbles in the ice trap the air from the past. And it's the only archive we have on the planet. It allows us to look at CO2 and methane, nitrous oxide, over 800,000 years.
The documentary is called Glacial Balance. Joining us now by phone from Seattle to talk about the balancing act between public health and climate change is documentary filmmaker and producer of Glacial Balance, Ethan Steinman. Welcome to the show, Ethan.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us in the studio is paleoclimatologist Lonnie Thompson. He's a research scientist in the Byrd Polar Research Center at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ed.
Ethan, you started the film with scientists like and including Lonnie Thompson taking core samples from glaciers. Why start the conversation there?
That's where my own investigation began. I initially started looking at the idea of doing a film on glaciers because of some chain emails I was getting when I was living down in Argentina, because there was a mining project going on between Argentina and Chile. And as I started kind of researching that, I think a natural first step was to try and contact Lonnie Thompson to find out a little bit more about the subject, and happened upon him during an excavation and was invited up there. So, not having much of a production plan at that time, went up and really started my own personal form of research with him, and that just kind of started the backbone of the project.
Lonnie Thompson, we associate you with the Byrd Polar Research Center, not the not a glacial research center, but that's where most of your work occurs now.
That's true. Yes, and in fact, over the last 40 years, we've drilled in 16 different countries, as well as Antarctica and Greenland, looking at that history of climate as it's recorded in ice around the world.
And to what extent is what you're seeing in one place being replicated elsewhere around the world?
Well, I think this is the beauty of ice. Ice has no political agenda as it changes from a solid to a liquid. It just melts. And what we see happening throughout the tropics is the loss of ice, the acceleration in the loss of ice. Some of the places where we've drilled, when we drilled Kilimanjaro in 2000, we drilled 6 cores to bedrock. And I just got a photo 2 weeks ago from our drill site on the Furtwanger Glacier, and the ice is gone. You cannot get those records now, and that was in 2000, only 13 years ago. So the changes that are taking place in the glaciers throughout the tropics, as well as the mid and high latitudes, all point in the same direction, and that is that the Earth is warming.
Ethan Steinman, we tend not to personalize climate change, although it's now an accepted process. Most people, it's still debated in some corners, but most people agree there is climate change occurring. Some of it, or at least some of it's man-made or exacerbated by humans. It still feels pretty personal, unreal to most of us. How did the issue of public health occur to you?
It was out of my own necessity to try and grasp the concept of what was happening. I'd seen other films, I'd read a lot about climate change and understood it in layman's terms from a scientific perspective, but never really was able to understand kind of who the individuals who are dealing with it today are, and wanted to kind of go out and just kind of go out in the field and understand what their perspectives were, what they understand about it, what's being done, and just kind of through that curiosity, it's kind of flourished a little bit as to how to go about finding out more about what the locals are experiencing and thinking about it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the intersection of human health, public health, and the climate change ahead. Ohio State's Mershon Center is sponsoring a series of events called Winterscape, a look at changing ice and changing ways of life. The first event is a screening of the documentary we're talking about right now, A Glacial Balance by Ethan Steinman, at the Wexner Center. It's coming up this week. For more information, visit our website at WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you with more information. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. Ethan, the people who live near and depend on the ecosystem of the glaciers already are feeling the changes in just a generation, and Lonnie Thompson just mentioned in just 13 years, where they were extracting ice from the glaciers. The glaciers are no longer there, or at least at that point. You interviewed a man whose family has made its living collecting and selling the ice, which people from where we live don't even think about that as an occupation. And now he's the only one left doing it in that community, which was astounding. And before that, there were many.
Right. And that was something that even with scientists that I've been talking with who've seen the film, they were surprised because this was an activity that was going on in Peru as well. And the gentleman you spoke of, Baltazar Ushka, is in Ecuador. In Peru, this activity is now outlawed because of the situation of the glaciers, because they realize that they're a finite resource. But when I heard about this activity, I mean, it really... I don't know. It surprised me in a way that a relationship that a community had or that an individual has with the glacier was much more personal than just waiting for the water downstream. It was his livelihood, and it continues to be his livelihood.
What else about the relationship with the glaciers? As the glacier in that community and a couple of the other ones you looked at, are as they melt, they're having to move where they plant their crops, where they live, and so forth. Tell us about that. This is happening right now.
Right. What I've found, communities are having to move initially just because of lack of water, or in some cases in Peru, over where I filmed with Lonnie, there was a community that they were damming off some canals, which they were then covering in cement as a way of maximizing the amount of water they were able to receive downstream. So they're dealing with short-term plans in order to be able to continue living where they are. But they have, I think, they have an idea that things aren't going to be this way in the future, and kind of planning on what to do both from the short-term and long-term, but just accepting the fact that they're going to have to make drastic changes at some point.
To what extent are the governments getting involved in this and understand the ramifications on public health in their countries?
From what I've seen, the governments seem to understand, and different countries seem to be addressing in different ways. But there's a lot of resentment. There's a lot of resentment, I think, towards the world community at not supporting their local efforts, because I think the way they're having to deal with this situation now is a way that here in the States, we're not having to deal with it. So maybe we're not addressing it as much as they would like or as we should.
Lonnie Thompson, have you been pretty much welcomed in terms of your research and in extracting the glacial ice and sometimes the water?
Yes, very much so. And I've actually testified in Parliament in Peru on the issues of climate change, because they recognize Peru has 70% of the world's tropical glaciers. So they're the first to really see the impact of the loss of these glaciers. There's a very distinct wet season and dry season. 76% of their electricity comes from hydroelectric power. And so during the dry season, when the only source of water is the melting of those glaciers, they can't produce the electricity they now need for their grid. So they're seeing these changes taking place, and that same water goes downstream, and it's used for irrigation, it's used for municipal water supplies. So they're aware of the problem. It's how do you deal with it and the scale of the problem that's becoming overwhelming.
Paul in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Paul. I'm told you're from Haiti.
Yeah, I'm from Haiti.
Mm-hmm. And the melting glaciers, you say, are affecting life in Haiti.
Oh, very much so. And my wish is some university really could go down there and really work with the people, because the government is doing is not doing anything about it, okay? And I believe in 15, 20 years from now, there are some streets with downtown of Haiti, they will be covered with the sea.
Thank you very much, Paul, for the call. Island communities, island countries are very much endangered by this. Lonnie Thompson?
Yes, we've been measuring sea level rise for over 150 years. And if you look at those numbers, over the last 100 years up until about 1990, sea level was rising at about 1 to 2 millimeters per year. And from 1990 to the present, it's rising about 3.3 millimeters per year.
Which sounds so infinitesimal, so small.
It does, except that when you think about this over time and the fact that it's accelerating, as the glaciers accelerate in the rate that they're melting and temperatures of the world rise, and if you increase the temperatures of the oceans, which is happening, you also, oceans expand and sea level rises because of that. So even though Haiti has no glaciers, it will certainly be impacted, as will all island nations and coastal cities, by what's happening to the glaciers, both in the polar regions and in the high mountains of the world.
Ethan Steinman, before we let you go, can you talk to me about what some governments are doing besides you can't use the ice. There aren't ice cutters out there anymore, or very few. What else are governments doing to address the melting of the glaciers?
In Bolivia, I spoke with the Minister of Environment, and there they were really, and they continue to be active on trying to get kind of a dialogue on the world stage going on ways that on a global scale changes can be made, because for them, they realize that, I mean, their carbon emissions are next to nothing compared to what's going on around the world, but they're seeing the effects. So they're really trying to campaign to get changes made on a larger scale. But there's a lot of anger because there's not necessarily a recognition worldwide or an interest in making these changes to a degree that will be substantial in the long run.
Lonnie Thompson, in your research and what you found over the ages in the ice, is the glaciers have come and gone before, right?
Certainly this is the case. You know, as the climate of the planet has changed due to natural forcings, things like orbital forcings, our position relative to the sun. I mean, these are natural, and they occur over thousands of years. The concern today is how rapid the change is, and over very short periods of time. Societies can adapt if changes are gradual. It's the abrupt changes that we're really concerned about.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I want to say thanks to Ethan Steinman. He's a documentary filmmaker and producer of Glacial Balance. Ethan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll continue our conversation with Lonnie Thompson and also bring in a public health expert who has looked into this issue as well. And once again, want to tell you that Ohio State's Mershon Center is sponsoring a series of events called Winterscape, a look at changing ice and changing ways of life. Ethan's film, Glacial Balance, will be screened there this week. If you have more questions, you can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the intersection of climate change and public health. An example of that intersection, the World Health Organization estimates that by the year 2000, already 150,000 deaths per year were due to disease-related to climate change. Still with us in the studio is paleoclimatologist Lonnie Thompson, research scientist in the Byrd Polar Research Center at Ohio State University, which with the OSU's Mershon Center is sponsoring a series of events called Winterscape, a look at changing ice and changing ways of life. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now from Washington State is Howard Frumpkin. He's dean and professor of environmental and occupational health sciences at the University of Washington School of Public Health. Among his leadership roles between 2005 and 2010 at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, he served as special assistant to the CDC Director for Climate Change and Health and created programs in climate change and in healthy community design. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Anne.
So how does the public health response to climate change differ from, say, an outbreak of the flu or E. coli?
Well, in many ways, it's no different at all. We assess the hazard, we identify which populations are most at risk, and we take steps to prevent people from being harmed. It's just that this is a bigger and more complex problem than most of the ones we faced in the past.
Lonnie Thompson, I wanted you to go back to the issue of abruptness and how abrupt this is compared to scenes from, 100,000 or 200 or 300,000 years ago. What do we mean by abrupt compared to the past?
Abrupt means occurring in the lifespan of a human being. Over these short periods of time, we've built a lot of infrastructure. We've never had over 7 billion people living on the planet, depending on the food resources, the water resources, and all of these become at risk with abrupt changes that we're currently seeing.
Dr. Frumpkin, when public health preparedness was established, the idea of public health preparedness was established, was climate change in the equation?
It really wasn't, Anne. A lot of our current thinking about public health preparedness goes back to 9/11, and bioterrorism was on everybody's mind. After we began working on bioterrorism preparedness, many of us in the field realized that we should be thinking about all hazards preparedness. So whether it's an earthquake or a hurricane or a chemical spill or a train crash, a lot of the same preparedness maneuvers have to be in place. So we think now about all hazards preparedness, and it turns out that's a pretty good toolbox for dealing with climate change.
And it doesn't seem like it could be, but climate change includes some, when you break it out, disease, natural disaster, all of those sorts of things.
Exactly. There's a whole inventory, and it's kind of a gloomy one, unfortunately, of impacts that climate change may have on public health. Some of it is the direct effects of heat. We'll be seeing more heat waves, and heat waves are bad for people. There's the question of worse air quality. Climate change worsens air quality, and that in turn is bad for cardiovascular health and respiratory health. There's the increasing risk of infectious diseases. A big issue will be that, as Lonnie referred to, as agriculture is impacted, as some areas will have more difficulty growing food and growing livestock, food supplies will be changed, and even the nutritional quality of food will diminish in some cases. Well, bad nutrition and poor availability of food are bad for health. There are impacts on mental health, which are not very well understood, but very interesting and potentially important. And even the big picture issues like migration of populations, civil conflicts, outright wars when resources become scarce, all may be part of the picture.
Lonnie Thompson, in your work and travels, you've been all over the world, as we mentioned earlier, taking the ice samples. To what extent are you seeing these sorts of less obvious relationships with climate change take place?
Well, I think we see a lot of local impacts on people who live next to the glaciers. Glaciers in many indigenous people are considered sacred places, and the loss of those glaciers are very, very personal to them. But along the Quelccaya ice cap, we see lakes that have formed at high elevation, and now when there's an avalanche, we get a mini tsunami and floods downstream. And this lake didn't exist until 1991. And in other cases, we see lakes that have formed, and as the glaciers retreat, they drain into another valley. So another valley gets flooded, and then the one that they were draining in dries up. So the local people can't graze their alpaca and llama in those valleys anymore. So they're dealing with these changes in real time.
Howard Frumkin, do you study those communities that Lonnie Thompson's talking about? Does the study of them help prepare the rest of the world?
In many ways, it does. Some of the indigenous communities, the communities in the far north where climate is changing fast, are in some senses the canaries in the coal mine. We're seeing, in some cases, Inuit communities in Alaska that are needing to move. We're seeing small island nations in the Pacific where rising sea levels threaten their way of life and even the very land that they live on. In river basins in Bangladesh, even the poor communities in the Philippines that were affected by the recent storm, it's impossible to pin any one storm on climate change, but that kind of event is becoming more and more common. And so the human impacts are really not hard at all to find around the world.
And yet they, at this point in the game, tend not to be the communities that are causing the problem.
Right. One of the big ethical dilemmas in the climate change area is that those of us who have been responsible for most of the carbon emissions over time, and therefore for much of climate change, are not the ones who are being hardest hit by the effects of climate change. There's really a disconnect between who the victims are and who the emitters of carbon have been over time. In my view, and in the view of many, that gives us a particular moral responsibility to take this very seriously and to be sure that when we protect people from the effects of climate change, we pay a lot of attention to those who are hardest hit.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the intersection of public health and climate change with Howard Frumkin, Dean and Professor of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the University of Washington School of Public Health, and also Lonnie Thompson, paleoclimatologist and research scientist at the Byrd Polar Research Center at Ohio State University. If you have a question or comment for either of our guests, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Health disparities will be more pronounced by climate change. Is that one of the ethical imperatives that you were talking about, Dr. Frumkin, that we need to take care of these people? Disease is going to be more rampant in the poorer countries. They're already struggling with disease that we don't even think about on a day-to-day basis in the United States.
Well, I think that's right. There is a moral imperative to think about the health and well-being of people in poor countries because we've been part of the problem. But, you know, it doesn't. It's not only a global problem. Here in our own backyards, the impacts of climate change will disproportionately affect people of lower means and of vulnerable populations. For instance, if food becomes more expensive as agriculture becomes harder hit, We know very well who's going to be most affected by rising food prices, and that's people who have a hard time putting food on the table as it is now. Something like 15% of our country is now food insecure, meaning that they have difficulty putting food on the table at some time during the last month. And we know what people do when they're food insecure. They go out and buy the low-cost, calorie-rich, nutrient-poor foods that at least give them the calories they need, and that's been a contributor to the obesity epidemic. So it's not hard to trace the chain of events that may occur as climate change affects agriculture and carry that right through to nutrition and well-being.
And likewise, disease carriers like mosquitoes and so forth thrive more in warmer climates. And as the climate warms going north, we're going to have more problems with West Nile virus, those sorts of things.
Well, I think most listeners know the phrase tropical diseases. That's mm-hmm. a reminder that some diseases exist in particular ecological settings, in particular ecological niches. And as those tropical climates expand their range farther north from the equator and farther up to higher altitudes, then we can expect some of the diseases that live in those areas to expand their range as well. Here in the Pacific Northwest, pretty far from Ohio, we've seen the emergence of a tropical disease called Cryptococcus gattii, something that was well known in the tropics for many years, but to our great surprise, it showed up in the temperate rainforests of the Pacific Northwest in the last decade, affecting people. So this is kind of a harbinger of things that may be coming. We have very good research suggesting increased risk in some areas for dengue, for malaria, and for other vector-borne diseases. And we know that waterborne diseases, the diarrheal diseases that cause many outbreaks every year across this country, are more common after severe rainfalls. Well, severe rainfalls are becoming more common, and so we think we may have a bigger challenge with the diarrheal diseases as well.
Lonnie Thompson, are those sorts of challenges, those sorts of threats, something that you see in the ice?
Well, certainly in the ice, we can look at annual variations. And one of the things I'm concerned about is that we can go back thousands of years, and we can see events that have occurred in the past that very much may have a climate connection through El Niños. The influenza in 1918 killed over 50 million people. That occurred during a major El Niño event. And one theory is that wind patterns change, and that changes the course of migratory birds. And migratory birds interact with birds they don't normally interact with, and it allows for these diseases to vector. And if you go back to earlier periods, back to 1789 to 1800, there was a very big El Niño event. And if you look at the impacts of that event in places like India, in one sector of India in 1791, over 600,000 people died from starvation because of the monsoon failures associated with that. And of course, these events are global. They impact many parts of the world, and therefore they can have a huge impact. And if you go back further, 1345 to 1370, there's another very big event. And of course, that's the time of the plague. It's a time of the collapse of the Yuan dynasty in China. And these disease climate connections are very complex. But if you were making the climate argument, you'd say the bacterium had to vector to lice, and the lice had to vector to fleas, and fleas to rats, and then, of course, to humans. So how climate plays the back role on our system through time, to me, is a very important issue, and it has a lot of bearing on what we may see going forward in the future.
Tom in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Yes, thanks. I just want to say this summer I witnessed some of these changes, especially relating to glaciers. When I hiked from Mount Hood on the Pacific Crest Trail through the Northern Cascades to Manning Park in Canada, and Washington and the Northern Cascades apparently had over 700 glaciers at one time, and I read where there's less than that now by maybe 100 or so, and I actually have photographs of glaciers that are obviously much smaller than they were, 50 years ago. And I noticed also Mount Hood has a lot of glaciers, and there were articles in the paper there when I stopped at the Columbia River, and they were talking about in August the people had to cut back because they wanted to have enough water for irrigation, because Hood River is an area where there's a lot of big orchards, you know, mainly apples and pears. So anyways, I just wanted to add that.
And when you were noticing all of this, Tom, were the associations with the climate change being made? Was that point being made?
Well, it was being made to me because I've been following this subject for 4 or 5 years, and I've read every book in the Upper Arlington Library. I think there's 25 books on climate change and global warming in that library alone. Of course, not too many people take them out.
Which raises an interesting question. Tom, thanks so much for your call.
You're welcome.
Lonnie Thompson?
I would comment on what Tom said. If you look at Glacier National Park, we were just out there this summer. But when it was formed back in 1912, there were 150 glaciers. There are now 24, and they're all disappearing very rapidly. And in the next few decades, there'll be no glaciers in Glacier National Park. It's just a sign of the change that's taking place.
And Tom makes a very good point about the changing water flows. Here in the Northwest, we depend on not only the glacial melt, but the annual snowpack melt to supply our waterways, and that in turn supplies water for irrigation and for electric power generation and for recreation and for people to drink. So as those water supplies are threatened in coming decades, we expect impacts on all of those areas. We'll have to balance water for irrigation and agriculture with water for the salmon runs, with water for people in the cities down the rivers. And that's going to be a very thorny set of problems.
Are the issues of the rising sea levels going to be something that we see noticeably in the United States in coming years, Lonnie Thompson? In my lifetime, could I see people migrating away from the coasts to avoid it?
I believe so, and more so because of the storms. As Howard said, you can't tie any one storm to global warming, but it's the magnitude and the number of these storms that we're concerned about. And when you have storms like Sandy that come in and you have this storm surge that comes in, does tremendous damages on coastal areas. And as sea level rises, that storm surge will come further inland. And we forget that in places like New York and New Jersey, there are over 45 Superfund sites within a half a mile of the coast.
Meaning a high environmental impact if they break down.
They suddenly become a risk,
right,
as climate changes and sea level rises.
Just real quick, Dr. Fromkin, before we take a quick break, what about the coastal region? Are people, they love it there. I know people who move there for the view and say, poor you in Ohio, and I agree with them when it comes to the view, but what about that? How long is that? Do people expect that view will last?
Well, I think we'll see people needing to reconsider living in coastal areas, not only because of storms, but as the rising sea levels begin to intrude into freshwater aquifers in coastal areas, there will be what's called saline intrusion, where salt water gets into freshwater, and there isn't enough freshwater to go around. And so that sadness that people feel, that anguish of having to leave a place that they love, natural beauty is an important part of our lives,
mm-hmm,
and being in the places where we grew up is important to us. So this leads to the mental health issue. I mentioned this before. One of the ways in which climate change may threaten mental health and well-being is by compelling people to move from the places that they know and love.
We will return to our conversation about the intersection of public health and climate change with Howard Frumpkin of the University of Washington School of Public Health, and also Lonnie Thompson, a paleoclimatologist and research scientist at the Byrd Polar Research Center at Ohio State. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the intersection of climate change and public health with Howard Frumpkin of the University of Washington School of Public Health, and also Lonnie Thompson, paleoclimatologist and research scientist at the Byrd Polar Research Center at Ohio State University. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Peter in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Peter.
Yes, I have one question. Is there a possibility of such a disastrous thing as runaway global warming, because there's a lot of organic material tied up in the northern climate, and if that starts to melt, it could just sort of, you know, produce a lot of methane, which would mess up the planet's atmosphere? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Peter. Lonnie Thompson?
Yeah, well, I think consequences of change that we don't recognize coming are our biggest challenges of looking at the future. Degassing from methane clathrates in the polar regions as temperatures warm is a potential issue. Currently, about 50% of the CO2 that we emit every year is being sequestered. About 25% goes into the oceans, and another 25% goes into vegetation and plants, and the other 50% is added to the atmosphere each year. And for the first time in our recorded history of measuring CO2, which started in back in 1958, CO2 levels reached 400 parts per million by volume earlier this year in Mauna Loa. And there were 315 parts per million by volume when Charles Keeling first started making those measurements. And if you look back at the history, geologic history, we have to go back to the mid-Pliocene, about 2 or 3 million years ago, when temperatures were 2 to 3 degrees warmer and sea level was up to 82 feet higher than today, to find a condition where we had 400 parts per million by volume of CO2. One of the problems with climate change is that there's a lag in the system. It takes a long time to heat up ice sheets in the oceans, and therefore we will not see the full response in the climate system to what we've already done for another 20 to 30 years.
There's no takebacks at this point with what we've already done.
What's already in the system is in the system.
Howard Frumkin, I wanted to go back to, I think, one of the callers, something that they brought up regarding, I think it was Tom from Upper Arlington talking about there's 25 books in the library. He's taken them all out. He's read them all, but he's not sure very many other people have. And one of the 10 essential services of public health that I read about in one of your papers includes informing, educating, and empowering people about health issues. You've written that only 1 in 5 Americans understand climate change very well. How important will it be going forward that more people are taking out those books in the library?
Well, this is one of the big issues of our times, and I think that in the same way that knowing how to vote and knowing how to balance a checkbook are essential to being a functioning citizen in our country and in our world, understanding climate change at some rudimentary level is going to be very important going forward. We need good science education across the board, and we need, in particular, for people to understand the fundamentals of climate change. We also have an opportunity here. The education isn't all doom and gloom along the lines that we're discussing now, Anne. There's some good news in the middle of all of this, and it's important to frame our discussions of climate change accordingly. For example, some of the things we have to do to address climate change happen to be really good for health, well-being, and quality of life. One example is transportation. Transportation accounts for about a third of our greenhouse gas emissions, higher in some places in our country. If we shift from carbon-emitting kinds of transportation, and one of the biggest carbon emitters is the single-occupancy motor vehicle, we shift from that to walking, cycling, and using transit, that's one of the main strategies for addressing climate change by reducing our carbon emissions. But it's also one of the main strategies for addressing the obesity epidemic. And we need all of us to be more physically active. Most physicians are telling their patients to get out and be more physically active these days. So using less energy to move us around in motor vehicles, using more of our personal energy to move us around in active transportation modes is good both for climate change and for our health. There are lots of examples of where addressing climate change is good for us.
Yeah, you call them the co-benefits, right?
Right.
You've said that the preparedness often occurs in the face of scientific uncertainty. So has there been any special challenge in getting local governments to focus on an issue that in some quarters still is unsettled? For instance, in Ohio, people have been working for years to try to get more mass transit, any light rail. The trains have gone away. Nothing links the three biggest cities in the state anymore except for cars and buses. You live in the Pacific Northwest where it's very, very different. It doesn't seem to influence people that much when it comes to things like mass transit.
Things are not that different here, really. Around our country, we've got an overdependence on cars and not enough development of transit. But that's a small example of a larger problem, which is in tough economic times, mm-hmm. all of us, both at the family level and at the government level, deal with what's urgent more than what's important or long-term. We need to make long-term investments based on long-term thinking. That means transit systems, That means locating houses and communities in areas that are safer and so on. But you asked about challenges at the local level of doing these things. Well, boy, it's really tough. Local officials are pressed to do what has to be done today, tomorrow, next week, and not necessarily to think in terms of long-term solutions.
Right. You mentioned that public health and these preparedness issues really came to the fore after 9/11, which was an absolute catastrophe. I mean, it was one of the worst things that's ever happened in our history. That's what it took for that. What will it take for people to respond to the issues of climate change?
Well, unfortunately, it often takes a disaster to get us to act, but it behooves us all to plan for what we need to do so that when a disaster occurs, we react in a thoughtful, far-reaching, helpful way instead of just a knee-jerk way. One example is at the other coast in the New York, New Jersey area where they're rebuilding after the superstorm last year. They're thinking very deliberately about ways to rebuild the coastal region there in more resilient and in safer ways. That's going to do a great thing for the people of the region over coming decades.
Lenny Thompson?
I would also say that universities can play a big role here. I'm very proud of the fact that OSU, we now get 25% of our energy, electricity from alternative sources, from wind power. We just put in a geothermal field to heat and cool our dormitories. There are lots of things that we can do using today's technology, which actually makes jobs for the state of Ohio. And I think in some ways these extreme events are bringing the issue of climate change into the here and now. And I just saw a recent poll from Stanford University for Ohio for 2013. And when they asked, has global warming been happening? 75% of Ohioans say yes. And when they asked, should government limit greenhouse gas emissions for U.S. businesses? 83% say yes. So opinions are changing, but I think maybe nature is playing a role of bringing it into a time frame that humans normally respond to.
And yet, we were just talking before this hour about how the Ohio General Assembly is considering legislation that would ease requirements on utilities on what percentage they want to turn to renewable energy sources, to what percentage they want to cut consumer consumption of energy. They want to reduce these requirements, not increase them.
Well, there are some vested interests who want to do that, but I think we need to go with the majority of people in Ohio and their opinion on these issues.
I'll add one point there. One of the impacts of climate change on people's health and well-being is the indirect impact on people who work in industries that are going to have to change over time. So if any of your listeners happen to work in coal mines or in coal-driven electric utilities, they're going to have to be taken care of. We're going to need good green jobs that pay well and that are satisfying jobs so that people in industries that have to shift won't be left out in the cold, so to speak. Very important that as we make the moves toward a more sustainable future, that even the people who are most invested in the kinds of industries that contribute to climate change aren't left behind.
I would agree totally with this. Having grown up in West Virginia and actually having come to Ohio State to study coal geology, it's important that the people be trained into these new technologies and the new way of life. And we cannot leave these people behind.
Chuck in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Chuck.
Well, thank you. My question is this. Why is global warming bad for me? I live here in Columbus, had a very nice mild winter, had a very low heating bill last year, and it just seems like life has gotten better here.
So why
should I care that much about what happens on the coast?
Okay. Lonnie Thompson?
Well, if you were to look at things we were talking about, diseases, Lyme disease, which is spread by ticks, if your winters aren't as cold, and the mosquitoes that spread the West Nile virus. You have more of that, and we see that in the statistics in Ohio. But I would say the bigger issues, are, you look at the Great Lakes here. We've lost, since the 1970s, 70% of the ice cover in the winter has disappeared. And as a consequence of that, we're changing those ecosystems. We're losing more water through evaporation in the winter because there's not an ice cover on those lakes. This makes it harder for industry that ship to the ports on the Great Lakes. We're also changing the temperatures in those waters. On Lake Superior, the waters have warmed 4 degrees Fahrenheit over this period of time, and this impacts the fishing industry. That's a $4 billion industry a year. You wouldn't think that fishing for perch, yellow perch, and whitefish in the Great Lakes, but also agriculture in this state. $5 billion a year in income comes to the state through the agriculture in the state. So it's not us individually. We got to look at the big picture and the influence on the greater numbers of humans on this planet that we have to be concerned with.
Howard Frumpkin, is Chuck one of your challenges?
No, I think Chuck makes a good point. There are going to be winners and losers as climate change unfolds. Some places will get milder climate. Agriculture up in the north part of Canada and in Siberia will probably get better, not worse. So Chuck's exactly right that in the short term, in some places, things actually look pretty good. But I agree with Lonnie that Chuck would never call and say, well, why should I care about terrorism? After all, the World Trade Center was far, far away from Ohio. Because at the end of the day, we're all in this together. And if changes are bad in many places and good in a few places, overall, that's not a process any of us would want to live with.
Thank you, Chuck, for that call. Adam in Columbus, you are on the air with Howard Frumpkin from the University of Washington and Lonnie Thompson, paleoclimatologist here at OSU. Welcome.
Thank you, Ann. My question was, what are the ramifications of climate change going to be on animals, whether it be extinction or, movements of different communities, and how that will affect us?
Lonnie Thompson, do you want to take a swat at
that? Well, it's not my area of specialty,
right.
But I know that there is issues with fish. Some fish require colder water, and they have to migrate as long as migration is a possibility for them. And one of the problems we have is not only the number of us, but the fact that we have fields and fences and roads makes it more difficult for animals to migrate as they have in the past before there were so many humans on the planet. So all of these inhibit their migration. But on the positive side, humans can see the need for this and help in this process. So there are ways that we can offset some of the damage that we've done.
Howard, anything to add?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, and I think the answer is a very complex one. Very, very small animals like ticks and mosquitoes actually like climate change. The warmer weather and the greater rainfall are good for them. They metabolize faster, they reproduce faster, they feed more frequently. And of course, that's bad for us because that's the way diseases are spread to people. Some animals, like marine animals, will suffer with conditions like ocean acidification. Here in the Pacific Northwest, the oyster farmers are having to take the oyster seedlings all the way to Hawaii and let them mature there because the pH in the ocean has gotten just a bit too low for the oysters to grow normally here. So that's one example of a species that is suffering considerably and that we need to adapt to continue to live with. And then some of the big animals, like polar bears, famously are suffering because their habitat is diminishing. So I think we'll see a wide range of effects on various members of the animal kingdom. Some will directly affect our health and well-being. And as Lonnie said, one of the things we can do is anticipate those changes and take steps to protect animals when necessary.
Howard Frumpkin, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Ann.
Howard Frumkin. He's Dean and Professor of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences at the University of Washington School of Public Health. And Lonnie Thompson, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Lonnie Thompson, he's a paleoclimatologist and a research scientist at the Byrd Polar Research Center at Ohio State. His work is featured in a new documentary called Glacial Balance. If you want to learn more about that, it'll be screened this week at the Wexner Center. Go to WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.